You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We have another episode to play, and we'll be going off of the Shakespeare Sonnet series. I've been kind of going on a run lately. I think we've been doing 3 shows in a row, and I do have one more going on tomorrow, kind of back-to-back-to-back-to-back, due to some fill-in spots I filled in for. And so, I mean, we get through Shakespeare sonnets faster, and so I guess it's a good thing. And so I hope you guys are enjoying it as well. We left off at Sonnet 25 yesterday, our last episode, and so today we'll be finishing sonnets, I guess, 26 to sonnet 30, I think. I think we'll kind of have time for 5 sonnets as usual. But other than that, that's basically it. And so we do have some songs, of course. I do have songs from Willie Dunn again, because why not? And we'll play some ads, show promos, and PSAs. And the first song of the day, Honey on Fire by Willie Dunn, and then we'll get right into the readings. So we'll be right back after this.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Storytelling is powerful. Our stories carry personal and collective histories, build bridges of understanding, and shine light on unseen truths. Your story, your voice, your power. CITR and Discorder is excited to announce the release of 5 unique podcasts as a part of its Power and Voice podcast incubation program. Power and Voice is an entry-level educational program created by CITR to surpass traditional barriers to entry into the medium of spoken word radio and podcasting. The result is a series of podcasts demonstrating a wide diversity of work in genre, structure, and content. Tune in every day from April 14th to 18th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. to hear Power and Voice storytellers share their stories on their own terms and in their own words.
Did you know that community radio stations in Canada broadcast in more than 65 different languages? This is where stories come alive and where we come together. But as big international media dominates the spotlight, local news and local voices struggle to be heard. Our government must help these local stations continue to do what they do best, serve the unique needs of our communities. We're asking you to go support the Community Radio Initiative at mycri.ca. Stand with us for community radio future. Local voices matter. Yours, mine, the hosts on this community station. You know it, I know it. Now it's time for the government to support it. With your help, stations like this one will continue to do amazing things. It's called the Community Radio Initiative. Learn more at mycri.ca, and together we can make a difference for our community. Again, mycri.ca, because local voices are what shapes our neighborhoods.
The Evelyn Saller Center is recruiting volunteers to help design and implement relief initiatives for the downtown Eastside community. If you're looking to get experience relevant to your area of study while helping to support the homeless population of Vancouver, email us at esc.volunteerprogram@vancouver.ca or find our page on the City of Vancouver website under Evelyn Saller Center. positions are flexible and designed to be convenient to students. Those with an interest in health, communications, or psychology are encouraged to apply.
You never see me again.
Ebola.
Xin chào và hẹn gặp lại.
Happy birthday.
I go to National Engineering College.
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 Fridays from 2 to 3:30 p.m., it's the Beppe Crespin Presents radio show.
It's CITR's 24 hours of radio art in a snack-sized format.
Difficult music, harsh electronics, dark ambient, drone, spoken word, cut-up collage, and general Crespin weirdness.
Beppe Crespin Presents, Fridays at 2 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
Streaming at player.citr.ca.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
But there was smoke in the shoreline, smoke in the breeze, smoke in the trees. Don't worry, honey, sweet child. Fire's gonna flare one more time. Smoke around, smoke on the water, smoke on the shore, smoke on the breeze, smoke on the trees. Don't worry, honey, sweet child. Sun's gonna shine one more time. One more time, one more time, one more time, one more time. Don't worry, honey, sweet child. One more time. One more time. One more time. Fire's gonna flare. One more time. Don't worry, honey, sweet child. Fire's gonna flare one more time.
And we are back. That was Honey on Fire with some ads, show promos, and PSAs. I kind of got mixed up here, and so we actually are going to read sonnets 21 to 25 today. So we'll get, instead of 25 to 30, I was looking ahead quite a little bit there. So yeah, we'll start off with sonnet 21 today. So let's give this one a read. So is it not with me as with that muse, stirred by a painted beauty to his verse, who heaven itself for ornament doth use, and every fair with his fair doth rehearse, making a couplement of proud compare with sun and moon, with earth and sea's rich gems, with April's first-born flowers and all things rare that heaven's air in this huge rondure hems. Oh, let me, true in love, but truly write, and then believe me, my love is as fair as any mother's child, though not so bright as those gold candles fixed in heaven's air. Let them say more, that like of hearsay well, I will not praise that purpose not to sell. Just by reading this, we can get a sense of the sonnet kind of rejecting the hyperbolic ornamental language of traditional poetry and traditional poetic praise that favors a sincere and a truthful approach to love and beauty. And so we read lines 1 to 4. So is it not with me as with that muse, stirred by a painted beauty to his verse, who heaven itself for ornament doth use, and every fair with his fair doth rehearse. Now we see that the speaker sets himself apart from other poets, hence that muse, who's inspired by, in a sense, artificial or superficial beauty, as in painted beauty. Painted beauty kind of reminds me of Dowessa's identity in Edmund Spenser's The Faery Queen, which I highly recommend. I took a Renaissance course with Dr. Stephen Guy Bray, and we went over the whole entirety of Spenser's The Faery Queen. And I wrote two essays on it that specifically dealt with Dowessa. One was Dowessa and another character, but Dowessa is a character that is manipulative and evil. She's basically a devil, basically. But there was a lot of instances where I wrote, or instances in the poem where she is I think it was a painted forgery or something. I'm not sure quite, but her identity metamorphosizes quite a lot. And there were a lot of scenes where she, quote unquote, painted her beauty, and so she portrays herself as beautiful, but in reality she's a old hag, to quote from the poem. And so that kind of reminds me of Dowessa. But going back to the sonnet, the speaker kind of sets himself apart from other poets. Quote-unquote, that muse, who are inspired by the artificial or superficial beauty of the painted beauty, and who embellish their verse with comparisons, specifically using heaven and all its imagery to kind of ornament the subjects. And so the phrase painted beauty can imply both artificially, as in makeup or disguise, and a kind of empty mimicry as well. And so, with a dismissive and cliche tone, kind of, And so that's kind of interesting. So we can kind of see here with lines 1 and 4, where the speaker, in a sense, refuses to rely on the poetic exaggeration and borrowed beauty to praise his beloved. We move on to lines 5 and 6, making a couplement of proud compare with sun and moon, with earth and sea's rich gems, with April's first-born flowers and all things rare that heaven's air in this huge rondure hems. And so the phrase proud compare here is significant, as it kind of catalogs typical poetical images of celestial bodies, nature's kind of richness and rare beauty, which is all contained within the huge rondure, which is a poetic term for the roundness of the world or the vault of the sky. And so these accumulations of images kind of mimic the excess it criticizes. And so I see this as a parody, in a sense, overblown metaphors, which kind of reminds us that many poets kind of lazily recycle conventional symbols. And so I think Shakespeare is trying to critique this tendency as dishonest, or at least insincere. Moving on to lines 9 to 12, oh, let me true in love but truly write, and then believe me, my love is as fair as any mother's child, though not so bright as those gold candles fixed in heaven's air. So here, the speaker kind of outlines his own poetic principle, and that is truthfulness. And so rather than drawing from myth or natural wonders, he prefers plain, honest expression, kind of said here as fair as any mother's child. That kind of offers a universal praise without singling out supernatural comparisons. And the phrase, though not so bright, acknowledges that the beloved, his beloved, may not shine like stars, gold candles, but that's besides the point. So the lines 9 and 12 kind of, for me at least, sees... So for love, according to the speaker, doesn't really require exaggeration to be seen as valuable or authentic. And so the love is humanly. Love can be just humanly. It doesn't have to be celestial. And that humanity itself alone is just what makes it beautiful. Moving on to the final couplet, lines 13 to 14. Let them say more that like of hair say well, I will not praise that purpose not to sell. So it's kind of drawing a hard line. And that hard line is the implication that others may indulge in flattering hearsay or poetic fashion, where it says say more, but the speaker won't cheapen his praise, that purpose not to sell. And so this line kind of plays the idea of commodifying beauty, where it kind of turns affection into salesmanship. And so that's kind of significant. I think Shakespeare is kind of defending a more grounded poetic ethos, and critiques the performative nature of it, performative nature of love poetry that kind of aims to impress or seduce. And so there's a sense of artistic integrity here, which prioritizes authenticity over applause. And so that was Sonnet 21. We'll move on to Sonnet 22. My glass shall not persuade me, I am old, so long as youth and thou art of one date. But when in thee time's furrows I behold, then look I death my days should expiate. For all that beauty that doth cover thee, is but the seemly raiment of my heart, which in thy breast doth live as thine in me, how can I then be elder than thou art? O, therefore, love, be of thyself so weary, as I not for myself but for thee will, bearing thy heart, which I will keep so chary, as tender nurse her babe from faring ill. Presume not on thy heart when mine is slain, thou gavest me thine not to give back again. So lines 1 and 4 here. We see a metaphor again being played. The speaker kind of begins with the metaphor of the glass being a mirror. And the refusal to believe that the speaker or he is aging as long as the beloved appears youthful. That's significant. And so the coupling of both youth and thou implies it's an intertwining of their beings, how their fates are emotionally, perhaps spiritually fused together as one. But the future looms in time's furrows, and the wrinkles that kind of may one day appear on the beloved's face. But when those marks of age kind of, you know, come to be, the speaker will accept mortality. And the verb expiate kind of adds a moral or even religious weight, where his death will be a kind of payment or atonement for the time's passing. So that's interesting there. Lines 5 and 8, for all that beauty that doth cover thee is but the seemly raiment of my heart, which in thy breast dost live as thine in me, how can I then be elder than thou art? Now here the logic of love, in a sense, becomes metaphysical. The speaker claims that the beauty's, or the beloved's beauty, is a raiment, clothing, of the speaker's own heart. Interesting. And so this image kind of collapses the boundary between the bodies and the selves. The heart swapping is mutual, where it says thine in me and mine in thee. And it's an ideal of romantic and emotional reciprocity. And so as long as the beloved is young, the speaker cannot be old. So they're just one together, or just one another. That's significant here. Lines 9 to 12, O, therefore, love, be of thyself so weary, as I not for myself but for thee will, bearing thy heart, which I will keep so cheery, as tender nurse her babe from faring ill. Now we get a shift to a plea or admonition. The speaker kind of asks the beloved to take care of himself, not out of vanity or duty, but because the speaker's heart lives inside him. And so the imagery of the tender nurse caring for a baby kind of casts the speaker as both a guardian and a dependent. We get a lot of interplay between guardian and dependent here. And the word cherry, which means careful and cautious, kind of further emphasizes the emotional vulnerability. And the comparing, I think, kind of to nursing, the comparison to nursing intensifies the intimacy and the stakes of mutual care. And so that's significant there. The final couplet, presume not on thy heart when mine is slain, thou gavest me thine not to give back again. So here it's basically saying that if the speaker dies, the beloved should not trust in his own heart because it contains the speaker's. And the last line, thou gavest me thine not to give back again, recalls the language of romantic vows or oaths, kind of a sacredness to it. But Yeah, that was Sonnet 22. Before we hit Sonnet 24 or 23, I have a song to play from, of course, Willie Dunn. This one I really enjoy, and so we'll give this one a listen. It's called Smokin'. So we'll be right back after this. Here we go.
Wasn't much more than a child when we met, though it's been a long while, I remember it yet. Why? I heard the old folks tell us. We laughed and we talked and walked and we danced, rolling through the fields, but the bitter romance, the heat of the love, made the sun jealous. The night came much too fast, the long light of summer did not last. Be somewhere in the past. When you hit the road, I never asked to be left out in the cold. You put out the fire, I put you left the smoke. Like a smoldering desire from a heart that's just been broken. You doused those flames that I would stoke. Might have put out the fire, but you left me through looking. Winter hit me like a sudden storm. Didn't have your arms to keep me warm. Eyes warm, deep upon the water. I bet you thought you took everything with you down the line. There was a little something that you left behind. In the sweet springtime, there was a baby daughter. Each day stayed a little longer, while the sun smiled even stronger. Didn't keep track of where you wandered on your winding road. I'll never again be left out in the cold. You put out the fire. Like a smoldering desire from a heart that's just been broken. You danced the flames, maybe you were joking. You might have put out the fire, but you left me smoking. You put out the fire, but you let me smoke. Like a smoldering desire from a heart that's just been broken. You danced the flame, maybe you were in joking. You might have put out the fire, but you left me smoking. You might have put out the fire, but you left me smoking.
That was Smokin' by Willie Dunn. We'll get into Sonnet 23. As an unperfect actor on the stage, who with his fear is put beside his part, or some fierce thing replete with too much rage, whose strength's abundance weakens his own heart. So I for fear of trust forget to say the perfect ceremony of love's rite, and in mine own love strength seems to decay, overcharged with burden of mine own love's might. Oh, let my books be then the eloquence and dumb presagers of my speaking breast, who plead for love and look for recompense, at more than that tongue that more hath more expressed. Oh, learn to read what silent love hath right, to hear with eyes belongs to love's fine wit. Okay, so lines 1 to 4, we begin with two striking similes. First, the speaker compares himself to an unperfect actor, a performer so overcome with stage fright that he forgets his lines. And so the metaphor here taps into the tension between the inner feeling and outer performance, where the failure isn't from a lack of passion, but from just too much of it. I think that's kind of where he's coming from. And we get the second simile. It's more primal, where a fierce thing whose strength's abundance weakens his own heart. And so here we see that passion becomes self-sabotaging. It turns in on itself. So rage and love, although they seem opposites, are emotionally intense and disorienting in the same way. And so both of these metaphors, in a sense, suggest that love, like fear or rage, can be so powerful that it can disrupt one's ability to express it. And so we get two striking similes in the lines 1 to 4. Lines 5 to 8, so I, for fear of trust, forget to say the perfect ceremony of love's right, and in mine own love's strength seem to decay, overcharged with burden of mine own love's might. Now we see the speaker turning inwards. He explains that because he fears trusting the beloved or himself, he cannot perform the perfect ceremony of love's rite. So this implies that love has its own formal structure, its own expected performance, which the speaker fails to deliver. It's a bit of a paradox here. And so the speaker is, in a sense, weakened by the strength of his own love, but the word overcharged adds a sense of being overwhelmed as well. And so his love is too much to contain, and this excess renders him inarticulate. Moving on to lines 9 and 12. Oh, let my books be then the eloquence and dumb presagers of my speaking breast, who plead for love and look for recompense more than that tongue that more hath more expressed. And so, unable to speak his love aloud, the speaker ultimately turns his writing, so his books, to stand in to for his speech. And so they're dumb presagers. They're silent indicators of his feelings, which are more true than words. But one interesting factor here is that he claims that the silent texts plead for love better than a tongue that more hath more expressed. And so here there's a sense of envy or critique towards those who speak more fluently, but perhaps with less sincerity. And so the speaker implies that deep love resists articulation, and that too much expression might kind of cheapen the feeling. And that really makes sense. And also, one of the reasons why I love the sonnets is because it's super relatable to us even to this day. But from the lines 9 and 12, I really understand that. And it's a real thing where too much could kind of cheapen the feeling. Cheapening the feeling is such a good expression here because it really does. And the whole importance of balancing out everything, I really think, matters and is what this poem is trying to convey here. You know how if you convey too much love, it can kind of overpower. If you convey too much sincerity, it can kind of overpower and cheapen it. I understand and I relate. The final couplet, oh, learn to read what silence love hath right, to hear with eyes belongs to love's fine wit. And so the final couplet here offers an aphoristic close. The beloved is urged to read the unspoken language of love, to use their eyes as ears, and to hear the speaker's silent affection. This is also an appeal to a deeper kind of perception, a fine wit or a refined understanding that can interpret emotional truth beyond language. So that was Sonnet 23. We are moving on to Sonnet 24. Mine eye hath played the painter and hath stilled thy beauty's form and table of my heart. My body is the frame wherein 'tis held, and perspective it is better painter's art. For through the painter must you see his skill, to find where your true image pictured lies, which in my bosom's shop is hanging still, that hath his windows glazed with thine eyes. Now see what good turns eyes for eyes have done. Mine eyes have drawn thy shape, and thine for me are windows to my breast, where through the sun delights to peep, to gaze therein on thee. Yet eyes this cunning want to grace their art. They draw, but what they see, know not the heart. Now, lines 1 and 4, we begin with a metaphor. His eye is a painter, and he has stelled, which means engraved, or kind of placed like a star, the image of the beloved's beauty into the table of his heart, which is a metaphor for a canvas or tablet. And so the beloved's imagery is not just remembered, but is inscribed permanently. His body is a frame, which emphasizes the idea that the beloved's image is super central to him, that it's contained within his physical being. And so the final line of this quatrain kind of brings in the idea of perspective. Visual accuracy and depths in painting. And so this perspective kind of allows for a realistic rendering, and the speaker suggests that it's a highest form of a painter's art. So that's interesting here. Lines 5 to 8, for through the painter must you see his skill, to find where your true image pictured lies, which in my bosom's shop is hanging still, that hath his windows glazed with thine eyes. So here Shakespeare kind of plays with the artist-viewer relationship. The beloved must look through the painter, the speaker, to see their own image. And it suggests that the subject cannot see themselves directly, but only as rendered by others, by another's perception. And the bosom's shop is like an artist's studio, even a gallery, displayed within the speaker's heart like a portrait. Glazed with thine eyes, the windows are glazed, suggesting a sense of transparency through which light enters, and artifice, as in glazed paintings or stained glass. Lines 9 to 12. Here we see the reference eye for eye, eyes for eyes, and eyes drawn the beloved's shape. And so the eye kind of becomes the window through which others or the sun itself can look in and see the beloved's image residing in the speaker's heart. So that's significant there. Our last couplet, yet eyes this cunning want to grace their art, they draw, but what they see know not their heart. Now here's the volta, and it introduces a complication where the eyes, and by extension art, are skillful, but they still lack true cunning. They can only represent outwards appearances, not inner truths. And so the speaker kind of acknowledges a limitation here, where although he can paint the beloved's image in his heart, neither his nor the beloved's eyes can be seen or can see the essence of each other. And so the heart, which is the inner self, kind of remains elusive. And so that is significant here in the final couplet. So before we move on to Sonnet 25, I have another song from Willie Dunn called Bear and Fish. And so we will give this one a listen, and then we will continue on with our Sonnet 25. So we'll be right back after this.
Clouds are rising from the sea.
lonely land with a sandy shore. Eagles rising in their flight, the streaks of spirit in the dawn, water jumbling from the clouds, wash down the thunder paths, and rivers glistening in the sun. Beneath the water and the wave, the spirit lives within its world. And the barren fish beneath the sun. Thus the cycle has begun. The artist and his wooden cup, the dreamer and his vision stream, through canvases and color schemes, the legends of the days gone by, sought the mysteries of the sea, and naked on the noonday shore, with powdered flag and a brush unfurled, widening legends of his world, of beaver, badger, hawk, and bear, wistful dreams a dreamer dreams, boldly drawn the colored scheme. Shapes upon the board, with earth's foreknowledge yet withdrawn, as men upon the desert sand, drinking from the drinking gourd, the sacred bear in search of fish, the fish beneath the water's wave. The rivers tumbling to the sea, the cycle of a mystery.
That was Barren Fish by Willie Dunn. Sonnet 25. Let those who are in favor with their stars of public honor and proud titles boast, whilst I, whom fortune of such triumph bars, unlooked for joy in that I honor most, great princesses' favorites their fair leaves spread, but as the marigold at the sun's eye, and in themselves their pride lies buried, for at a frown they in their glory die. The painful warrior famous for worth, after a thousand victories once foiled, is from the book of horror raised quite, and all the rest forgot for which he toiled. Then happy I, that love and am beloved, where I may not remove, nor be removed. Beautiful poem here. The lines 1 and 4 kind of sets the stage for contrast between the blessed by fate, in favor with their stars, and himself, who is denied public honor and proud titles. And so the word boast kind of carries a hint of vanity, suggesting that public acclaim is shallow. Meanwhile, the speaker claims a more humble, unlooked for joy, suggesting something quiet, maybe private, and perhaps more genuine. And so the phrasing that I honor most expresses that this joy is not only more meaningful to him, but just more honorable in essence. Lines 5 to 8, great princesses' favorites their fair leaves spread, but as the marigold at the sun's eye, and in themselves their pride lies buried, for at a frown they in their glory die. So here Shakespeare uses a metaphor of marigolds that bloom in sunlight to describe the courtly favorites of powerful princess. princess. And so their beauty and success, where it says fair leaves, are entirely dependent on the favor of their patrons, like marigolds opening only when the sun shines. And so the pride lies buried within them, invisible and repressed, or repressed until a single frown from the prince, where their withdrawal of favor kind of causes their glory to die. And so it could be seen as a critique of the unstable and performative nature of political power and reputation. And so where one's worth is kind of determined externally and can also be revoked instantly. We move on to lines 9 and 12. The painful warrior, famous for worth, after 1,000 victories once foiled, is from the Book of Honor, raised quite, and all the rest forgot, for which he toiled. Now here, the speaker kind of expands the critique to valor and military glory. Even a painful warrior, quote-unquote, someone who has endured great hardship, is at the mercy of public memory. And so a single failure underdoes a lifetime of success and erases him from the Book of Honor. And so we see a hyperbole here of 1,000 victories. And this emphasizes how disproportionate and unforgiving fame can be. And we see this as another version of the earlier idea, where public recognition is not only unstable, but it's just fundamentally unjust. And you see this with beautiful wordplay, how Shakespeare gives us an idea of all of this through the beautiful wordplay he writes. Moving on to the final two lines, the final couplets. We see a kind of a turn to love here. Then happy I that love and am beloved, where I may not remove, nor be removed. And so we see there's a volta. A volta, for those of you guys who don't know, it's called a turn, where there's a shift in the poem's kind of in the poem's story or the poem's message. And so we see a volta here. And you see a lot of voltas coming from the final couplet in the Shakespearean sonnets. And so that is why a lot of the voltas will come in the last two lines. And so the speaker kind of reveals the source of his true joy, which is mutual and enduring love. And so the repetition of love and am beloved emphasizes reciprocity and emotional permanence. And so the final line here, where I may not remove nor be removed, is especially powerful because it suggests a relationship rooted in constancy, which is unlike the volatile favors of princess or the fragile praises of the world, where we see in the earlier lines and stanzas. Quatrains. And so there's also a spiritual or kind of metaphysical depth here as well, where love in this context isn't subject to the whims of fate or status or history. And so that's also very significant as well. So in a sense, this poem kind of critiques the societal values of fame, honor, and power, and instead finds a quiet sense of triumph in love that is reciprocal, constant, and self-sustaining. So I guess we see an elevation of private affection over public acclaim, and we see that this poem also kind of suggests that love will offer a kind of immortality and certainty that worldly success cannot. And so that's what we get from this poem here. But we have already come to the end of the show. We went through sonnets 21 to 25. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I most certainly had lots of fun analyzing, but I will be having another show tomorrow at 4 p.m. And so tune in to dive into Sonnets 26 and over. But other than that, I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of the day. I myself will be heading over to YVR Airport to pick up my grandparents. They have just arrived, or they will be arriving, I think, in an hour from South Korea. And so that's very exciting for me. But other than that, please enjoy the sunshine. We have been getting tons of it this week. And I think it will continue on maybe until the end of this week. I'm not quite sure. I just hope it continues on for the longest time possible. But yeah, that is the end of today's show. Have yourselves a wonderful rest of the day. And I will see you guys again tomorrow with more poetry and music. Thank you all, and have yourselves a wonderful day. Bye-bye.